Hello, you're listening to the Stinging Fly podcast. My name is Ian Molini. I'm the nonfiction editor here at the Stinging Fly. In every episode of this podcast, we ask a writer to choose work from the archives of the magazine, which they read and then chat about for a little while. In this episode, we've got Stephen Sexton, a poet from Northern Ireland whose debut collection, If All the World and Love Were Young, was published earlier this year to much critical acclaim, and which won the Felix Dennis Prize for Best First Collection back in October. Stephen chose two poems by another Northern Irish writer we've published many times in the magazine, Sinead Morrissey. We spoke after a reading Stephen gave in Books Upstairs in Dublin, and thanks are due to Morris Earls and the rest of the Books Upstairs team for their generosity and patience. And indeed, thanks to the Arts Council, without whose support we wouldn't be able to make this podcast. Anyway, I really hope you enjoy this episode. If you do, don't be afraid to tell your friends about it or to leave a review on Apple Podcasts. That really helps us out. Okay, here's Stephen Sexton. Stephen, welcome to the Stinging Fly podcast.
Thanks, Ian. Lovely to be here.
Thanks for doing this. Very excited to have you on. So today you're going to be reading and talking about some poems by Sinead Morrissey.
That's right. I hope to.
Was there any reason particularly you chose Sinead?
Several, I guess. I mean, Sinead has, as a poet and as a person, has been very important to me for a while. I mean, she was one of the first people who helped me understand how poems work, I feel. Maybe most importantly, she was my supervisor at Queen's University in Belfast, where I did a PhD. I was doing a creative writing PhD. She was she helped me understand what I was doing with that, the outcome of which has been a book that I published recently. So she's an extremely important person as an artist and as a person for the way I think about poems, and I suppose in some ways how I think about how you know, a poem might exist in a world, in an ethical sense and an artistic sense. So yes, many reasons, all of them pretty significant.
So you're going to read Grammar. So can you tell me a little bit about where Grammar came from? And
yeah, so Grammar's 2008, which is some time ago. So I guess in the years since then, you know, she's won major prizes in poetry. She won major prizes at the time. I've got a feeling she just won the UK's National Poetry Competition around the time of this poem. Since then, you know, many significant things. But I think there's definitely a kind of aesthetic that works in each of her books that is quite distinct. So this is, I suppose, somewhere in the middle of her publications.
Mm. Okay, do you want to read it?
Grammar. I look up from William Strunk's Elements of Style, and there it is, the river depositing ships on the city's shimmering rim, the outsized girl with her hoop, John Kindness's patchwork fish, with the docks in its sockets like a wash of oil. My back has been turned so long, I thought the whole magnificent shebang had gone up protesting in a pillar of smoke. But the faces on the train are rail as taxation, and the sea-locked causeway is holding. I read again. Do not join independent clauses with a comma. The possessive of witness is witnesses. How do you punctuate a soul in two places? I leave half of it here, take half home to my son, with his bath accomplished and his sleep suit on.
Seeing the reference to Elements of Style right in this first line of the poem, I think it, when I was rereading it this morning, I was thinking how much of a sort of awareness raising tactic that is. Almost you read it being conscious of its sort of grammar and its style more so than you might normally be, or at least it kind of signals that this is something that's going to be of importance to the rest of the poem. And this question of punctuation between, I guess, in a literal sense and in something more metaphorical, I mean, how do you think that works in the poem? Is it Does it focus things a bit?
I think it does. I mean, I think maybe its main function, maybe rhetorically, and this is as a sense of order or a sense of the proper way to do things or the proper way that language is supposed to work, that there are rules that govern it that, you know, are, you know, tangible and are always true. And I think, I mean, the poem kind of takes exception with that idea. I mean, grammar, I guess, as a principle is about order and correctness. And maybe it's not too much of a leap from there to suggest that correctness involves a kind of conservatism or that there is a way that the world works that we can demonstrate. So I think to establish that right at the start is to ask some questions about that. And to quote from it. I mean, the other thing to say, I suppose, is that, you know, the poem's a sonnet, so it's engaged in its own kind of formalism to an extent. But it's, you know, I guess the major question in it as a poem and perhaps as a sonnet is that question, how do you punctuate a soul in two places? What relationship does language have to a person? Do the rules of language relate to the rules of being a person? So it seems to set that kind of opposition up. I mean, particularly the poem is about Belfast, in particular strange icons of Belfast. A woman, a giant statue, I guess affectionately known or correctly known, I'm not sure which, as Nula with the hula. It's just the outsized girl with her hoop. I'm pretty sure that's what that's known as, and the patchwork fish, which I, as far as I think, is a kind of riff on the salmon of knowledge that's right on the Lagan, the river in Belfast. So it's taking these kind of icons and establishing, I think, a sense of order or a sense of grammar against the city, against Belfast. I guess that's the introductory part of the poem. So establishing, I suppose, these icons of a very particular city that perhaps has been disordered, and, you know, applying a textbook. I mean, that's what this is. It's one of these books that I don't know if it's often creative writing, but I've certainly seen it in a lot of creative writing bibliographies, that this book should tell you how to write, or at least tell you what the rules of writing are. I think it's a good thing to question that.
Definitely. And I feel like the end of the poem brings in this sort of personal aspect to it as well. This question of maybe there's the writing self, that imaginary self that you put forward, and then there is the domestic self and the personal life that you have. And you get the sense, I guess, from reading it that they are two clauses perhaps in the same sentence, but there is nonetheless some sort of division between them. Is that something that you think she's trying to get out there, that there is some sort of difference between the writing self and the living self?
I think there is, and I think it's maybe also a separation between the real and the ideal to some extent. And I think that's shared over the way the poem works, the sonnet works particularly. But, you know, a phrase like, but the faces on the train are real as taxation. You know, that seems to be an argument of, you know, this is not theoretical, Mr. Strunk, this is real. You know, it's all well and good to have this theory of language that might provide order and steer the ship, to make a pun. But, you know, there's... Yeah, people on the train. There is, there's my son with his bath accomplished and his sleep suit on. And the fact that sort of real moment of the personal and the familial and the domestic and home life, etc., that it is devoted to, you know, two lines are devoted to that. The fact that they rhyme so neatly sort of wraps things up in a, not exactly humorous, but serious way, I think.
Mm. It's a warm-hearted sort of ending, if you know what I mean.
It is. There might be other things that that Sinead would care to say to William Strunk if she could. But I think the way that it ends is that, you know, there are faces on the train are real, that this theory of language might not match up when we've got to do other things with language.
Exactly. Yeah, language exists outside the book. Exists outside the rules. Basically, it does have to function as a communication device in situations that are less than ideal or situations that don't benefit it necessarily.
I think that's definitely a big part of it. And Yeah, I mean, I think it's sort of, I mean, there's a line right in the middle where it seems unclear. Well, maybe not unclear, it's ambiguous in the sense that it's pointing in two directions. My back has been turned so long, I thought the whole magnificent shebang had gone up protesting in a pillar of smoke. I mean, at that point, it seems... it's not sure, it's intentionally talking about either elements of style, the book, this you know, discussion about what proper language and grammar would be, or the idea of disorder in a city or a place. It seems to be applicable to both of those two conditions, and it's just I guess the start of the second half of the poem, where it offers those two things still at once, and then it turns to the real.
Mm. And I do love that real as taxation line. I think
it's a great one, isn't it?
Yeah.
A real as taxation and the sea locked causeway is holding.
Yeah, it's beautiful. Do you want to read another?
Gladly. Okay, another poem with Belfast in it. So it has an extract here that I'll read. Signatures. Belfast is a placemate for a corporate town, armed with all commodities as a principal haven, wood and good ground, standing also upon a border. Extract from a letter to the Privy Council from the Earl of Essex, 1573. 1. Where nothing was, then something. 6 months ago, most of this was sludge and a gangrenous slipway, dipping its ruined foot in the sea. A single rusted gantry marking the spot where a small town's population of Protestant men built a ship the size of the Empire State Building. Smashed cars and wreckers' yards flourished in between. 2. A skin-stripping wind. This morning I walk on concrete, smooth as a runway, with a full-scale outline laid in light of the uppermost deck. Railings as over a stern. Grass. Seating. The memorial for the dead hosts names I can't pronounce. Sjosted, Tossig, Backstrom, in immaculate glass. Once, I count a surname 7 times. So I mean, one of the things that I think Sinead is particularly marvellous at is interacting with Belfast in a kind of new way. I mean, I feel as though one of the things that I think is hard for a lot of people who grow up in the north of Ireland, but I mean, I suppose Sinead is of a generation that follows, you know, Paul Muldoon and Kieran Carson and Maeve McCookian, and, you know, people in that who themselves are you know, just after Seamus Heaney and Derek Mahon and Michael Longley. And I guess there's always this pressure of how to talk about a place and not be obliged or not be coerced into writing about what Belfast is known for in a you know, national sense and an international sense, which is to say a place of violence and conflict and that sort of thing. This does, that element creeps into this a little bit. But she does talk marvellously about, you know, about Belfast as a place of its history, its economic history. I mean, you know, at one point, as many people know, I'm sure. I mean, it was much larger than Dublin was as a city. I mean, like, I don't know, was it the world's largest producer of linen at one point? I mean, I guess some, you know, the linen triangle of the north. I'm not sure if that involved Belfast at all now that I think about it, but it probably did, or maybe it was further away. But you know, she's really interested in these, you know, actual histories of Belfast. Not that those other people aren't, but I think it becomes necessary to write about other things that are not violence. I mean, a curious line from the start of that extract that almost reads like a pun. I mean, this poem was published in The Stinging Fly in 2013. Yeah, Belfast is a placemate for a corporate town armed with all commodities as a principal haven, wood and good ground, standing also upon a border. I mean, it reads very strangely at this point, although the border issue is newer than 2013. I don't know if it's newer or not than 1573. But I guess there's all these ways that that she talks about history and these kind of small moments that lead to gigantic ones.
Yeah, as someone who, I've only been to Belfast a handful of times in my life. In grammar, you said it has these landmarks or icons of Belfast in it. And to someone who's coming from the outside, it's not going to recognize those. And sometimes I feel like there can be something nice about writing for people in the know, using the language of a community in a way that they're going to understand, that you don't have to explain. Another writer I know referred to this as shop talk.
Sure.
Which I think is a good way to put it. It's, it's taking sort of account of what people are going to understand naturally and choosing to explain or not explain, and hoping that they'll go with you, I suppose. In this, it's much more explicitly Belfast. Do you think that changes the way that she approaches it, that even someone with a very basic knowledge of the city would know its shipbuilding history? Like, to engage with something like that, which is so not quite like overdetermined, but certainly well known and well discussed and famous in its own right. Like, is that a difficult thing to engage with as a poet, to sort of go up against that well-known aspects of a city and try and find a way of representing them, I suppose?
I think it is. I mean, what you said just there reminds me of something I read a couple of years ago that has stuck with me, because I don't fully understand what it means. I was reading about William Carlos Williams and his and imagism, I guess, as a thing, and I guess how we make images. And I wish I could remember the person who wrote this article, but he quotes in it, I believe it's a he, and I believe he's quoting a Tibetan proverb. He says he is, but so we'll have to believe him. This is what he says. When is a horse not a horse? When it's a white horse. And I don't know exactly what that means, but I think there's a lesson in it for images, and I think there's a lesson in it for how adjectives work, because what the horse, the word horse as an image means to me, it's never a white horse. I see a lovely chestnutty horse. I see, going to almost break into song, I see fetlocks. I see a lovely mane, but it's never white. And, I guess it seems like that seems to be a really important thing for me anyway, about image making, it's thinking like, what is necessary here? Do I need to say white? And in the case of a horse, I think you do. I think it has to be a white horse. So I'm always really interested. I mean, if grammar is a poem that's kind of about communication and the properness of communication and the practicalities of communication, I'm thinking, how do these kind of images, how do they relate? How do they reach out? Are they understandable? And if they aren't, I feel echoes in this poem, where nothing was then something. Seems kind of like Genesis to me. It's been a while since I've read it, but out of nothing there's something. Similarly, a gangrenous slipway dipping its ruined foot in the sea is like a one of Heaney's great poems, Oysters. Orion dips his foot in the sea, as I recall. It feels like there are these echoes that are in it, these other kinds of histories that are happening. How exactly one deals with those big images, I'm not sure, but I guess there's another thing here of, a simile, which I guess is always used for clarity or explication. A ship the size of the Empire State Building, which is just a nice moment. I mean, that's where it's going, right? At least that's, for all intents and purposes, that's where it's going. It's also a small town's population of Protestant men. It's a nice break of the line there, that it's not a small town's population only. It develops, and I think we see similarly here, that movement that we might see in the first one. This is kind of historical, the first part of it. There's no I in it, but by the time we get to the second part, we've moved to the particular, a skin-stripping wind. This morning I walk on concrete smooth as a runway. It's back to this I, how the I is involved in history, society, And she's a marvelous poem that I could read forever called The Electric Edwardians, which is kind of about that, about finding a film of lots of, the finding of a film of lots of workers in a factory somewhere in the north of England, I think. And, you know, all these boys and men marvelling at how they can be filmed, they can exist on film. So it's, I mean, the turn of the century, so I think early 1900s. I guess the poem largely is about thinking about what's going to happen about a decade or so later, or a decade and a half later, you know, when the war starts. Like, you know, who are these boys? Who are these boys and men that are sort of prancing around the gates? They become actual people. And, you know, that movement from, again, from a theoretical history, a documentarian's clip, to the fact that they had actual real lives and had a terrifying future ahead of them, many of them, which I think is, I mean, it's always an ethical kind of charge, right, to say that this person in history is, you know, not just an example of something, they're you know, they're a person with a future and all that stuff. And I think a pretty deeply ethical act to treat those people as people and not examples of something.
That kind of thought, I guess, always reminds me of this wonderful John Berger line from And Our Faces, My Heart, Brief as Photos, where he talks about the need to see people in their particular life and in their particular time and place. And he says, as if people lived only history and nothing else. And sometimes, particularly in places that do have some sort of reputation or a set of understandings that people seem to have about that place, those are the places where the particular lives of people are the most easily sort of skipped over or erased. And I think Belfast probably fits into that in a way. Just the realities of people's lives are not necessarily the first thing that comes to other people's minds. It's more, well, this happened in 1910 and this happened in 1920, and it has this kind of historical importance, but a lived importance is something quite different.
I think so, and I mean, that's one of the best things that, make this too general, but I mean that's one of the things that poetry certainly did do is keep records, right? And, you know, that's what the old poets were doing, and I think it's important to note this in the record, you know, those people, that it wasn't a grand sweep and it wasn't this homogenous thing. It was, you know, lots of people who didn't get to have voices or didn't get to say things, that there's, you know, that there were eyes involved in all of these moments. Belfast is complicated in that regard, but I mean, Sinead's been really a wonderful example of how to write about a place for all its other qualities, not just that one.
Mm. It's interesting as well in this one, I think, the way that, as you say, that Genesis moment, because it's something that I think particularly in built-up areas, cities and towns, that you can, it almost feels like it's always been there and that it has always been this way and changing it would be difficult. But to think about a city in its sort of prehistory, I suppose, to think of it at that origin moment where there was nothing and now there's something, which suggests to me at least that there is the possibility of something else down the line, that the future is open, I suppose, rather than determined, like predetermined.
I agree. I remember reading, as you might have gathered, I have no memory whatsoever for people's names or anything, anything that's identifiable. But there's a couple of marvelous books about sort of prehistories in Belfast. And one of the interesting things that is claimed in one of these texts is that, so I guess like many cities, Belfast is separated by the River Lygon. And allegedly there is evidence that suggests that the east side of the river, which is where the Titanic was built, that was originally a kind of land of the dead, where those people who lived on the other side of the river, that's where they would live. And when people needed an elsewhere to take their loved ones, it was over that river, so that was a strange sight. Kind of, I guess, a magical kind of land in some ways, or maybe magical is not the word, but certainly a specialised kind of place, or a particular kind of place, which I just find kind of thrilling. I mean, I don't know if there's I think there are difficult things in that, to suggest that one side is the land of the living, one side's the a sort of land of the dead. I'm not sure about that, but, you know, rivers are always kind of enchanting. And certainly, I don't want to suggest that that's part of this poem, but, you know, this idea that from a nothing there comes something, you know, for that may as well be about poems, that may as well be about writing, you know, that kind of is what's happening, I think, with part of that. But it's also a marvel at something of this scale, this kind of achievement. And yeah, once I count to surname seven times is how that poem ends. Yeah, that this is a community thing, you know, this is, many people.
Mm. I think you're totally right about the sense of there being an echo in some way of the sort of writing process, and that there was nothing and now there's something. I mean, for you, how does a poem, when do you know that you have one?
You know, that keeps changing, and I try not to, I mean, yeah, it seems kind of resistant or something. I try not to think about that because I'm kind of frightened of doing the same thing twice. Although I can make my peace with that, doing the same thing five times worries me. So I try not to follow that. I mean, usually what happens is, you know, some kind of an interesting, you know, line or phrase or something comes into my imagination, and I sort of live with it for a little while. I feel as though I make it pass a test. You know, that it must prove itself to stay with me and stay interesting to me before I'll kind of proceed with it. I mean, I suppose, you know, one of the most fundamental bases of a poem, right, is that some one thing is like another thing, you know, the simile or metaphor, and that often happens. I feel as though that's maybe a straightforward way of doing things. Recently, I suppose, it's just a lot of stuff, like a lot of pop cultural stuff I find really, really interesting. Because I guess, you know, I spend a lot of time trying to write poems about paintings, let's say, and I got so tremendously bored of that, because you end up trying to find a new approach every time to talk about the particular language, the particular syntax, if that's the word that an image has that language doesn't, which is something I find like absolutely exhilarating. And I wonder if that's because I spent most of my life with images, you know, I mean, I didn't grow up without television. It was there, you know, and, you know, I still remember the first time I used the internet, which is bizarre that I can remember that, but I still remember the first feeling of doing that. And, you know, this isn't the place for my own kind of psychoanalysis, but I wonder if my interest in images is because I've grown up with images, you know, and I think frequently of you know, I guess video games for one thing, or films. I'm always trying to think of what it is that's unique about them, or photographs. Another thing that Sinead is marvelous at is writing about photographs. And I think that's probably one of the things that that I, you know, learned from Sinead is how to talk about images, which is something she does really marvelously. And I mean, I think in these poems, that's kind of clear. I think I'm always trying to think of what that relationship is between text and image. I mean, poems, for me, when they're at their best, are made of images. You know, I want to be able to see stuff crystal clear. That's kind of all I want. I mean, I want a poem to be like a photograph, basically. I want clarity, and I want to know all of its component parts, and I want them to arrange themselves together.
Yeah, I think, you know, one of the things that is kind of clear from reading your work, I suppose, is that one can be writing about something, and I think I do this myself. You find yourself drawn to some material of some kind, an image or a film or a song, and you're kind of obsessed with it for a while, and you kind of go back to it, and you think, what is it that's drawing me back here? And occasionally there will be a moment maybe where you realize it's not something that's in that image or in that song or in that film. It's actually something in your own life and something that you have to, there's something underneath it, something in you that's drawing you back. Is that something that you've experienced yourself, and that you're writing about one thing and then you discover you're actually on a different track altogether?
Absolutely. And that's kind of like a really thrilling thing. Like, that seems like a weird kind of translation, doesn't it? Where you can be looking at an image, let's say a photograph of some kind, and the way that you interpret that is like, oh no, that was something from my childhood that is not in the image. You know, that's the act of imagination or whatever that, you know, you can, which I find really interesting, that, you know, you could translate something so poorly that you end up thinking about something completely different, or you interpret something, maybe not poorly, but somewhat radically, where you end up with something else entirely. Yeah, frequently. I wrote with Sinead's help, in fact. She was my supervisor when I was writing what became a book that I've just published, If All the World and Love Were Young, which, you know, when I started writing that, I thought I was writing a book about Super Mario. I mean, as I mentioned, I was spending some time writing poems about paintings chiefly, and just grew kind of bored of it. I mean, I couldn't imagine a book of, you know, let's say 60 pages, each one of which, each page, each poem deals with a different kind of image. I couldn't imagine how you could have a sense of continuity in that or a pleasing kind of scale or anything like that. So I took a break from that and thought, well, what are other images? What other images matter to me? So thought it would be a strange kind of joke if I wrote a book treating the images of Super Mario as if they were real places, as if its strange landscapes were real landscapes. And it was a while into that, you know, I don't know about you, but I derive an awful lot of energy from something approaching mischief. So I had loads of steam, and just kept going. And you know, it wasn't until about 15 pages into this, 15 levels into this, where I thought, okay, I'm not actually writing about that at all. I'm trying to find a way to talk about grief, and this is the way that my imagination has kind of coerced me into doing that. So, you know, I'm trying to, not my intention, but subconsciously, I think, trying to find a way to talk about my mother's death, how to think about childhood, how to think about memory, how to, you know, I guess, think about how the world is different. And the way that clearly I was interested in doing that is going back to something that's absolutely fixed. You know, Super Mario World doesn't change. It hasn't changed since 1990. If we're still looking at it in 50 years, it won't have changed. It will be exactly the same. So when I guess when I'm thinking about how one interprets an image, I think what I'm really doing is charting how I have changed. I mean, if I had, you know, when I interpreted, if that's not too grand a word, for Super Mario as a child, I was just having a great time, you know, jumping over the Koopas, trying not to go down a hole. But as an adult, when I'm looking at that, I'm thinking, huh, what is that tree like? You know, what kind of tree is that? That looks an awful lot like the holly tree we have in our garden. And then all of a sudden, I'm thinking about my garden. I'm thinking about where I grew up. I'm thinking about the fields around it. I'm thinking, you know, what's different about me now that I'm interpreting this place as an adult. So it, like, in some ways it feels like charting the course of how I see things.
Yeah, I find often with things that are fixed, like you say, mountains can be a good example. They tend to just draw the mind towards what is not fixed and what is ephemeral in some way and what is changing and fleeting. And I think those objects from childhood are particularly good examples of that. Something that you can still go back to and you can still pick up and hold in your hand or look at on a screen and think, that hasn't changed, but I sure have.
Yeah. Yeah, what was I was listening to, you know, that lovely Neil Young song, Helpless? There's a line in that I forgot was there. All my best changes were there. Mm. Which the last time I heard that, I was thinking, what a line that is. Like, and all my best feelings, all my best memories, like, yeah, my best changes, like, that just seems like a really marvelous thing. But yeah, what you were saying, I guess, about fixity is what was interesting to me, you know, that I don't know about you, but certainly in the writing I tend to like, you know, there's a significant sense of order, but also disorder. And, you know, that's the thing, you know, that the mountain doesn't move, but you move around it. And, you know, I think it's important, at least for my imagination, to have some degree of order involved. I mean, probably another thing I think that's involved in that poem, grammar of Sinead's. I mean, that's the order, that's the rule. But, you know, you move around it. Seems like a possibility of reading that poem, or you go a long way away from it and, you know, come home and put your son to bed.
Mm. And there's always that sense, I think, particularly in grammar, where you're never quite fully separate from it either. You don't get to put a full stop in there. It's about a comma or it's about a semicolon or something. You know, it's a part of you in some way, but you may be quite a long ways from it, but you're never fully separate.
Yeah, I don't think so. I mean, there's always that's always going, isn't it? It's always that, that beat that's going.
Mm. Yeah, the monuments in your life, I suppose, you know, be they people or places or objects, I suppose. Sinead is someone who has also written fiction during her career. And I'm interested to know, I suppose, is that something that you have ever done or thought of doing? Or like, is there a difference for you in the approach that you might have? Or are you attracted to other forms?
You know, I've written two halves of two short stories. Regrettably, not two halves of the same short story. I don't know why. You know, I don't have the skills or the imagination to do that. And I have so much admiration for people who do that kind of writing. I don't think I have the imagination to carry it out. Yeah, I mean, I think when I did do some writing, it was of that nature, of sort of short fiction. I was trying to dislodge something. And I don't know how you work necessarily, but you know, I found myself being pursued by either a bad idea or an idea that I did not have the skills to work with. Nevertheless, I couldn't get away from it. You know, it was kind of, it felt like a block between me and what I actually wanted to do. So I figured that somewhere I got the idea that in order to exercise this, I should write it poorly and make it go away. So it did, you know, so I wrote until whatever I was thinking about went away and, you know, it didn't come back. The same thing happened again, but with a different kind of thing that was possessing me. I can vaguely remember one of the halves of a short story that I tried to write, which I still am convinced is a good idea, but, you know, I could be very wrong. So Weatherspoons, right? They're terrible. And they've got absolutely no atmosphere. Oh, wait, is this libelous? But I sort of was writing this, I thought, like they can't, you know, they're often in beautiful buildings, like they can't naturally be zero crack. So I wrote a story, a half of a story, from the perspective of the person who goes into a Weatherspoons every morning with a complicated piece of machinery to manually remove all the residual atmosphere that built up overnight, you know, because the buildings themselves want to have fun, but Weatherspoons would prefer that they didn't. So, you know, a guy has to come in with something that kind of resembles I guess a dishwasher hose or something in my imagination, and applies it to the building and all the atmosphere gets out so Weatherspoons can go about its day. But you know, I didn't get any further than that joke. In fact, that might be a joke, not a short story. In which case I should try to finish that joke. I don't think it's for me right at the moment. I've tried to write something else. I think I need to learn a little bit more about how to manage scale. As I say, order is good. When I work out what the order for me is or what the organizing principle is, I think I can do it. Or I have faith that I might be able to do something like that. But all this kind of surprises me because, you know, a lot of the poems that I like are narratives. You know, I like narrative. I've got no problem with narrative. I'm a big fan of narrative. So, you know, the poems of Matthew Sweeney, for instance, I love, and they're tiny, strange narratives. A lot of American poets I love. Someone like Larry Levis, a Californian poet, who just does incredible, often frightening stories in his poems. So that bit is really interesting to me. And I think what most compels me about a piece of writing is narrative. But as far as knowing how to do it, not yet. But nevertheless, I mean, there's so much that I've been reading lately that I utterly love, and so much in the magazine, of course. But someone like Louise Kennedy, you might know, I think is writing among the best things I've ever read in my life, and they're extraordinary. So I'm hoping that at some point I might develop the imagination to try to write that. If not, it's not the end of the world, I suppose. I've still got my half jokes, but maybe someday in the future.
Yeah, well, one of the reasons I bring it up, I suppose, is because I often wonder about the... I guess in prose writing, you have this sort of division between fiction and non-fiction. That's the grouping. Poetry doesn't have that division in itself. And I wonder a bit about, you know, as someone who's written about their own life, and I think in Sinead's work, she does bring in the I in a particular kind of way. She's writing about her own life, but she's also definitely writing about other people's lives and maybe blurring lines and fictionalizing things. And I guess I'm wondering does that divide ever come up in your mind, that there is a fiction poetry and a non-fiction poetry, or that there is some sort of... maybe it's just a beautiful meeting of the two where you don't have to think about that.
It has in a couple of ways. I mean, I did have to, when I was working on my book, I did have to make the choice to put myself in it in a way that I wouldn't usually do that. But I think the nature of what I was writing kind of called for that sincerity. I mean, it's a long elegy, and I mean, I had to be as honest as I could. But on the other hand, I mean, I wrote a poem a couple of years ago that, you know, involves a grandfather who was a miner. And I read this once, and someone said, "Oh goodness, you must have had a very interesting grandfather." And I said, "No, I made that up. That's how poems work sometimes, you know, you make them up." And I feel as though that was maybe a disappointing remark for that person, for me to say, like, "No, I made that up." But I mean, I am really interested in, you know, in the lyric and in the eye and who that character is. And, you know, a book like Claudia Rankine's a couple of years ago, Citizen, I mean, that was like deeply involved in thinking about who the eye is and who gets to have an eye and whose eye is untroubled. And I tried, I guess I'm after reading that book, I'm thinking, you know, who is this eye? I mean, I get to use this freely, you know, and you know, I get to be fictional or autobiographical at the same time. You know, there are no consequences for me. I'm very privileged in that regard, that I can, you know, I get to be any of those things and it's unchallenged. But I mean, I'm also kind of interested in the idea of, you know, I as a character, you know, the as if over the thousands of years that writing has existed, every time someone uses I, it's, you know, bizarrely another chapter in the life of I, the character, you know, who's had this remarkable life of unbelievable things that's lasted for thousands of years. I think that's kind of interesting. I mean, there's always a kind of embellishment to some extent, or at least, you know, writing exposes some kind of, you know, paucity involved with representation. I mean, the eye that writes a lot of these things, it doesn't succeed in describing exactly everything that it wants to. I mean, images are better, you know, at describing visual things, you know, and a photograph's much better than a poem can be. I think Berger has a great line, in fact, at some point where about photographs, he says something like, "Let us be under no illusions. Photographs are no more pieces of art than cardiograms are," or something to that effect. I don't have it exactly. That, you know, they're kind of scientific rather than artistic, which is something that I like to think about. But I feel as though that's a very tough, unfair, uncompromising kind of position. But I guess poems always, you know, writing of any kind is always dealing with the fact that you're not getting it right. So you're making something out of out of imprecision, you know, in some way. So yeah, whoever the eye is, autobiographical or fictional or whatever, it's never exactly right, I think, as far as making images is concerned, but that doesn't mean it can't be fun.
And I guess imprecision brings up the question of, well, when is it right? I
think
this is such a big question. And I often wonder about this for poets, because I think when you're writing prose and you have loads of words and loads of space, it's easier to change a word, or at least it seems like to me it would be easier to change a word in a piece of prose than it would be in poetry, where there's such weight on every single word. How do you shape that? Like, how quickly does it become fixed in your mind, and is it easy to go back to something and change it once you've written it, or to revise and improve? Do you find that an easy process or a straightforward kind of process?
I mean, I think that's one of those things that you have to try to get better at. You know, I think it's always hard. Now, you know, I'm really lucky to work with a lot of students often, and it's kind of exhilarating to see that, because I'm not necessarily right, but I have an idea of where I think something could go, and persuading someone that you don't need this bit, you know, horse is enough. You know, and I guess I'm really interested in, with a poem, and I think it's true for other things too, you know, the idea of leaving a space for somebody else to step into it, you know, that you leave enough of a space for somebody to come in and help with the interpretation, you know, and kind of in the sense that it takes two to tango. You know, there's the poem that's written and there's the one that's read, and I mean, I think often even in the, you know, the same person, if the author is also the reader, those are still different acts, you know. And I think making yourself somebody else in order to view it again can only be a valuable thing, is my feeling. I've come to enjoy it a lot more than I did. I mean, maybe like many people, I was certain I got it right first time round, and I did not. So allowing something to become something else, allowing it to be, in flux of some kind. That's maybe too dramatic, but allow it to be, you know, malleable, and it still has possibilities. I think maintaining one's imagination focusing on those possibilities, I think that's a healthy thing to do.
Yeah, it's something that Mia Gallagher brings up in her essay, which is in the latest issue of the magazine. Just being able, maybe not rushing through that first stage where it's still extremely malleable, and you kind of have this like rush of excitement maybe when you first get that image or that first line that comes to you and the first draft. And it can be, sometimes I think you can rush through that phase because of how exciting it can be, but then if you rush through too quickly, you fix things too quickly, and it becomes difficult to move them again.
Absolutely. I mean, the book that I wrote about Mario, I wrote that pretty quickly. In his first draft, I wrote it in probably about 2 months or maybe slightly less, just because I was so utterly focused on it. And I thought, this is ridiculous. Why would anybody do this? And sort of derived a lot of energy from it. But also it requires completeness. As anyone who might have played that kind of video game knows, there's a particular drive towards getting it complete. So I knew that there were 72 or thereabouts little pieces of text that I must write. So I was working towards that. But then when the practicalities, as I learned, of publishing emerged, you know, I was obliged to address some things that were less than good. And the idea of trying to get back into that particular way of thinking, I find extremely difficult. Because, I mean, for all of that book, I mean, that's not me. That's how I believe one might translate into English Super Mario World. So I could, you know, that was not a natural thing for me to do, not a natural voice for me to affect. So the idea of trying to get back into a voice or a tone that was a couple of years old at that point, I find extremely difficult. So I can sort of, I can understand those difficulties. But I think, I agree with that. Spending a lot of time in that first bit can be fun. But sure, you want to finish it, don't you? You want to get there. So it's kind of hard to do that.
Yeah. I suppose in that sense, we all, our past selves sort of become that fixed thing that we move away from and can't quite leave behind. So on that note, might be a nice place to finish it. Thank you very much for coming.
Thanks, Ian.